The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Those crosstalk we've had during the break, certainly we had a lot of stimulated discussion based upon our first panel, and we're going to try to continue that to meet that high standard, that example, with this next program, a session on our program. And that's going to involve focus on China in and of itself. And I'm very happy to have with us today Professor Wenjing Liu, who's a professor of law in China. She's associate professor at Jinan University Law School in the Guangzhou province of the People's Republic of China. She holds an SJD degree, and during the current academic year, 2008-2009, we're very pleased to have her here at the Washington College of Law as a Fulbright research scholar. And among her areas of research specialization is a comparative study of freedom of information in the United States in relation to the emerging transparency movement in China. And what I'm going to do is accompany her on this panel.
Now she can introduce you.
How is that for a very transparent transformation? Right there. And having introduced her that way, what we'll do is try to cover very thoroughly both the development of transparency regimes at the provincial level in China, which is a little bit unusual. Those of you familiar with the development of the Freedom of Information Act in the United States, you know that it developed at a national level. And then slowly but surely, all 50 states and District of Columbia and possessions came along with their own local counterparts to our federal FOIA. However, in a few nations of the world, not many, freedom of information developed from the ground up, so to speak, at the lower level, or comparable to our state level. That was certainly so with respect to Japan, when at the prefectural level, Japan started developing openness in government regimes. And it is true also with respect to China at the provincial level. So we'll be covering that. We'll also be covering the largest development with respect to transparency in China, very possibly, very arguably, the largest development with respect to transparency in the entire world, which is the fact that there is now a national level transparency regime in China that took effect on May 1st of this year, not long before the Olympics. And one of the things I'll ask Professor Liu about is whether there might have been any connection between the two. We'll be sure to cover both of those things, as well as any questions you might have. But first, what I want to do is, by way of further introduction to you, ask Professor Liu about her background, because the very fact that we have a Fulbright research scholar here in the United States from China studying comparative transparency, I think is quite a remarkable fact in and of itself. So let me ask you first, Professor Liu, how did your academic career develop to lead you to the point where you're here as such a remarkable example of international transparency yourself?
Thank you. This is the first time I realized this is a remarkable program. So we've been talking during the break about how can I become a Fulbright visit scholar. And lots of people think it's hard, it's difficult, but that's my feeling. To be honestly, it will be hard to those who are not lucky enough to be chosen. But for the for persons like me, I think I was lucky enough, but I won't feel hard. And I just feel it's lucky. I just write a proposal and a statement, introduced myself, and that was approved. That's the procedure. But to speak about the background of mine, I teach administrative law in Law School Jinan University. I've been there for 12 years, but I teach administrative law just, I think, since the year, about 10 years ago.
So you've been teaching administrative law as a general subject for about 10 years.
Yeah.
Thank goodness you must have started when you were 12. We have only a podcast of this program, folks. It's not a video cast, but if we had more than a podcast, I think the audience would understand.
Thank you. I started my... I went to school when I was 6 years old. And 10 years ago, sorry, 10 years after that, I went to Peking University when I was 16. And that was very unusual at that time, because I just took 10 years of, I think, primary school and high school. And that was just in the changing point. The system of the high education, high school education has just changed at my graduation year, so I chose the shorter one.
So you were able to graduate from high school and begin your college years, your university years, at a younger age than otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's part of your defense, I suppose.
And I started philosophy in Peking University for 7 years, and then I've been a journalist, a reporter, newspaper reporter, and a editor for 5 years. But that has nothing to do with either philosophy nor freedom of information, nor law, but has something to do with freedom of information. I was distributed to a small newspaper, but was owned by the State Bureau of Traditional Chinese Medicine, something else like that. I have no idea about that. I'm not a physician.
Would you be willing to reveal during what years you worked as a journalist in China? Because that might give a better feel for it to members of our audience.
5 years.
No, not the number. Nice try, but I mean the calendar years. Mm. Like, for example, from 2002 to 2007.
That was 1990 through 1995.
Ah, I was a little bit off in the calculation. All right.
Yeah.
90 through 95, you worked as a journalist.
Yeah. Mm.
That certainly provides a foundation for legal work pertaining to openness in government, or access to information. Just by way of comparison, it used to be that you could calculate the number of Freedom of Information Act specialists, people who worked in that field here, who had been journalists. You used to be able to count them on one hand. But now I think we have a far greater number of people in the United States who have gone from the field of journalism into law, specifically information policy law or freedom of information law. Oh, you may have been ahead of your time, though, in China.
Thank you. But I'm not realized about this fact. I don't know I'm going to study law and became a lawyer and a law professor during my working period in the newspaper. I just work and trying to find something that I'm really interested in, and I will be working for it for a lifelong time. And in 1996, I went to Jinan University. I applied for a job, and there is a position waiting for me, teaching philosophy. So I went to the social department of Jinan University, and then there has been a plan to arrange an administrative management department, and they need a teacher on administrative law. And at that time, we are very short in short of that kind of experts. So I went back to the university law school. I spent an additional 4 years there.
During those 4 years back at Peking University Law School, concentrating on law and specifically administrative law, did it occur to you, or do you remember now it occurring to you then, that you would ever be working in transparency law?
Actually, my dissertation is about the influence of WTO regulation to Chinese administrative law. So freedom of information is just part of that. And after my dissertation, I've been working on my dissertation while teaching. So I spent 2 years for full-time study, and another 2 years I have to teach full-time and do my dissertation in a spare time. And after the dissertation, after graduation, and I focused on this field for several years. And the reason I chose this topic is partly because a group of professors were working together on the same topic, and myself have been the consultant of several government agencies for several years. And in recent years, I've been my working group have been collaborating with the information agency of Guangzhou Municipality.
Did you say, and I'm sorry to make such a point of it, cooperating or collaborating?
Collaborating.
Collaborating, okay, I wasn't sure.
I wish my English can be better.
No. slight difference between the two, but mm-hmm. you were collaborating with the local government, the yeah. provincial government mm-hmm. in Guangzhou.
Yeah, and especially on rulemaking and documents, I think legal documents writing, they are not very familiar with this, but they have lots of things to do with that on this field. And the most recent thing we have been collaborating is on the data sharing, data exchange.
Data exchange,
yeah. Yeah, between government branches. So I think that's part of the question Mr. Ma Qiling have been asked just now. That's a very tough question also. Under the regulation of information disclosure and under the imperfection of freedom of information laws and regulations in China, so it's not very easy for us to do that.
Well, let me take you back, if I may, just a little bit in time from there, because you mentioned there came a point at which you were collaborating, working with the Guangzhou government.
Information agency.
Agency of the Guangzhou government, that province, which is a very large province of China, I know. Had any provinces of China begun work or to move toward transparency at that point? Had any of that begun yet?
You mean the regulation on freedom of information?
Well, no, not the 2007 or 2008 regulation, not the nationwide, but the movement at the provincial level toward freedom of information, a law at or a regime at the provincial level. I believe Guangzhou was one of the first, if not the first.
The first.
It was the first. Okay. Yeah. So my question to you is, at that time that you started, you were describing, had Guangzhou yet become the first, or was that still in the future?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Is Guangzhou still the first?
No. Do you know what year Guangzhou became the first?
Yeah, in 2003. Yeah.
Okay, and what you're describing, when you started working, was that before or after 2003?
After.
Oh, okay. So Guangzhou had already become the first.
Yeah.
And there were how many other provinces, do you know?
I think more than, I can't say provinces, because it's a little bit complicated for most of scholars who have ever been, who haven't ever been to China or know little about China.
That's partly my fault, because I should have said provinces or municipalities, including cities, that sometimes are not provinces, can but be as large as 32 million people. I know. So I should let you explain it. You'll do a much better job.
Actually, there were nearly 20 provinces and municipalities who have initiated a freedom of information regulation or rules. Now we would say regulation in the provincial level and rules in the municipality level, and if a regulation is passed by the state council, the central government, or the provincial or municipality congress, that will be called a regulation. And if that's the legislature part, and if the rule is passed by a government, for example, Guangzhou government and Guangdong province government, provincial government, that will be called a rule. That's a rule and regulation. The difference, a little bit complicated. And the rules and regulations can be nearly 20 by the end of 2006 on freedom of information in local governments. And there is one exception. That's in my province, the province where I was born. I was born in Shanxi, Middle East China. And Datong City, the not very famous city, Datong has passed a regulation by its local congress on freedom of information in 2005.
What would you say was the most important driving force underneath this movement at the professional level?
The important drive, I think, I'd rather say freedom of information in China is a kind of movement all around the country. I would say three basic elements in driving this movement. The first one, I think, is the economic and political reform in China. If you want to build a market economy, and more people earn their private properties, for example, their houses, their cars, and some other things, and they became taxpayers in a market economy system, and they are paying tax to this country, and they are, I think, they get to know more and more about the rights, or their right to know how the government running, how the government is using their money. So I think that's the inner driving of this country. So political reform always came along with economic reform. So that's the main reason. And another very important element that influenced the movement of freedom of information in China is China's accession to WTO in 2001. So that's a very important international influence to China.
That means you chose very well when you chose the topic of your thesis.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what it was on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You saw the significance of that in advance, I imagine.
Yeah, and one of my teachers saw the importance, and he suggested me, actually. And the third element is the technical influence. I think the progress of the technical using of the internet worldwide. It's become so convenient for we to know everything. So that's a very important motivation for government to public the information on their own will. They don't want to be published by someone else. So everybody, I think everybody will agree, if somebody knows something about me, I would like to say it myself first. That will get a better effect.
Well, that element right there that you've just described so well is one that I don't recall has been identified previously, at least outside of China, as an important factor. Basically, what you're saying, I think, is that the governments at the local and then ultimately the national level, they were concerned about information being not only out, so to speak, but up, available on the internet, and that they would rather be the agent of putting it up than have some outsider put it up. So they wanted to sort of get a hold of that process, get a handle on that. Well, that ties to a question that a number of people have had, I know, as to whether a big factor in the movement at the prefectural level first was the SARS crisis, a public health crisis. And I don't remember offhand, was that in the year 2002?
Three.
Okay. For those in the audience who are not familiar, for any of you who were born after the SARS crisis in the year 2003, it was a broad-based public health crisis in China, and it had repercussions around the world. And it was a disease. I don't even remember. Does anyone in the audience remember what SARS?
Sudden acute respiratory syndrome.
My goodness, there's someone who looks like a recovered SARS victim because he rattled that off in nothing flat. Sudden acute respiratory syndrome. And I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, because I can easily be wrong about something such as this. Did it originate or begin in China and became a political issue in China? Does that sound right to you?
I'm not sure if the SARS is originated in China, because I'm not an expert
in epidemiology.
Okay.
But it was a major concern in China.
Yeah, but that was part of the political life in China at that time.
Yes. And I know that there was a developing uncertainty, or perhaps a better way of phrasing it is dissatisfaction amongst the public in China with what information was or was not being disclosed to the public about the SARS crisis, about the medical emergency and what should be done or what could be done by members of the public. And I know I had people from my office who traveled to China in the early 2000s, if we can use that phrase now, who came back saying, yes, SARS was a big trigger there, they thought, they perceived, in much the same way that Watergate was a big trigger of openness in government and a lot of ethics in government related legislation and regulation in this country. Basically, in the wake of the Nixon years, our Congress and even our executive branch developed a more firm culture to make sure that would not happen again. And they compared the two. And I don't know whether it looked that way from where you sat at the time.
Mm-hmm. I will partly agree with you.
All right.
And if we study the procedure of the freedom of information in local government, we might see a lot of events that should be considered very important. But for a whole country, sometimes just for, I'd like to say, for the legislation or for the government to make a big decision, sometimes we need some event, and the event just come at that time.
A triggering event, so to speak.
Yeah, a triggering event.
And when you say that, you mean government at the provincial level in the early 2000s. Guangzhou first in 2002, I think you said, and then six or seven other provinces and large municipalities.
Yeah.
Do you know if those provinces, among all the others of China at that time, coordinated with one another and collaborated with one another to to make for stronger openness before the national government was involved at all?
Yes, Guangzhou Municipality have been collaborating with Sun Yat-sen University, and the law school, the dean of the law school, who's one of my friends, has collaborated with the government on this information disclosure rule before 2003. So they collaborate with universities.
So you're speaking of collaboration, not just among local governments, provincial governments, but even with universities, major universities with law schools within the provinces as well.
I wasn't in that group at that time, 2003. I was not lucky enough at that time. So I started I started collaborating with government agencies, I think, after 2003, 2004 or 5. I just can't remember.
Can you describe that process, how that worked? This is collaborating with the provincial governments and municipal governments.
Municipalities,
yes. And did that involve developing laws before they were enacted, or was it involved concerned with what we heard described this morning about the implementation and enforcement of the laws? Possibly both.
Before 2003 or?
No, after 2003.
After 2003, and we've been working on the sharing information or data exchange among government branches. And actually we have divided it into several parts. The first part is sharing the data, information of, I'm stating my vocabulary.
Database information in computer form.
Basic information of entities, legal entities, including government branches and enterprises and organizations. Those organizations are registered in government agencies. So that's databases sharing. The information about them sharing among government agencies. And the document has been published and it's being used very well.
That sounds very much akin, Professor Liu, to what has happened largely through the European Union with respect to data protection practices and sharing of databases transnationally. What they would call it, where the European Union has led the way and the U.S. has been dragging along behind, so to speak. That's sort of the Privacy Act end of things, that we would describe it that way in the United States. We have the Freedom of Information Act with openness in government, and then with respect to data protection, that would be sort of the Privacy Act part of it. So what you're saying is that in China, at the provincial level, you started moving not only with respect to access to information, but with respect to protection of information and business information, I imagine, as well.
And the later one is I think that's the main problem in recent China. Accessing government information is not the main question right now. We can much more easily get the information from the government agencies, much more easier than ever before. But the privacy and business secret protection is still a key issue, and the procedure is far more from perfect, I think. So that's the issue.
Let me challenge you, if that's all right, and I will do so gently, because you just said that access to information is not so much a problem or the problem relative to data protection, at least. Do you mean by that access to information at the provincial level or the national government level or both?
I would say both. I won't say our government have done it perfectly, but it's progressing. And if you visit the website, some of the provincial governments have English version on their website, and our central government even have a English version. So I always say I'm expecting a Chinese version in America's website. Because somewhere you have a Spanish version.
What is your website?
Address.
Sorry, www.gov.cn. Gov.cn. That's the central government.
Did everyone get the beginning part of that? I just want to be sure, because we have much interest in the audience. I can tell just from the numbers of pens that are poised here. From the very beginning.
From the great beginning, that was, if you write this address, and that will be the Chinese version, and in the top, you will see a English, and you click English, and that will be in English version. And lots of Chinese laws and regulations are in English version. They have a link on that website. And you can get the laws and regulations. That's official translation. And in some local governments, for example, in Guangzhou municipality, we also have an English version on the government website. That's www.gz.gov.cn.
Can you spell that?
G-Z.
G-Z.
It would be Z as in Z.
Yeah.
G-Z.
Yeah.
G-O-V.
That's the N. And the regulations of local government there, the English version, I guess that's a official translation, but not so good. Some are not so good.
It's probably better than the Chinese one we have here in this country. I would guess. Let me just take you up the final little part of the chronology before being exactly up to date, and that would be in your work, your academic work, and your consulting work with the Guangzhou government and others. When did you start to see the possibility, if not even a likelihood, that there would be a national level law or regulation on freedom of information? When did that start to look?
You mean the possibility of the regulation of the
at the national at the national level? Yes.
At the national level, I think that's about the same time as the local level. A lot of scholars in Beijing, most of them are in Beijing, are working on that. They've been keeping giving legislation advices and suggestions to the government, and some of them have published. For example, Professor Zhou Hanhua, I guess you might know something about him, who works in the China Academy of Social Science, and Professor Zhou and his fellows have been working on that, drafting the regulation of freedom of information in China, and they gave their suggestion to the State Council, and the draft was adopted.
It was adopted in the year 2006.
I don't know the exact year.
I know that the regulation
was published.
It was enacted or became official in some way in May of 2006 with an effective date. Whoa, let me take that back. May of 2007, I'm sorry, with an effective date of May 1, 2008.
Yeah.
Just like our Freedom of Information Act was enacted on July 4th, 66, had a full year for implementation effective July 4th or 5th, 1967.
You're right. That's the official publication date, but the draft published it to everybody. We can buy the book and visit it on internet, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
Prior to that?
Yeah.
Okay. and now it took effect in May of this year. Here would be the hard political question, or the cynical, Here would be the journalist's question. Mm-hmm. From your 5 years' experience as a journalist, a journalist would say, whoa, you now have freedom of information regulation at the national level. It's going to take effect. It did take effect May 1st, 2008, just before the Beijing Olympics. Yeah. Coincidence or not? Isn't that what the journalists would ask?
No.
I don't think so. I'm sorry. That's not what a Chinese journalist would ask. You got me. Yeah. You absolutely got me. In America, that's what the journalists would ask, yeah. I believe.
Yeah, but
I don't know what the answer would be.
Different culture.
Yes.
Different culture. And in China, the communist regulation has been, I think, been widely accepted by Chinese people. So I don't think Chinese journalists will ask that question. That's the different situation, except for the culture. And if I were the someone important, or the speaker woman of the National People's Congress or State Council, sorry. Mm-hmm. I would say no.
You would say just a coincidence.
Just coincidence.
Yes.
Yeah. Because we've been working on it for so many years.
But if you were Professor Liu, mm-hmm. Wenjing Liu,
yeah.
alone, what do you think? Coincidence.
Coincidence.
Sometimes coincidences happen.
Yeah.
But regardless whether it's a coincidence or not, mm-hmm. it still stands as a major example mm-hmm. to the rest of the world. Because although the freedom of information is founded in our conception as an emblem or a cornerstone of democracy, it doesn't necessarily have to coexist with democracy as we know it. Mm-hmm. It can serve a purpose in a different political regime, such as it's serving right now in China.
Yeah. And because I say that's a coincidence because sometimes you can't count the time. For example, the administrative enforcement law have been we saw the draft, I think about five or six years ago. And the draft came to the National People's Congress for no less than 3 years. And we have no idea about that draft, that bill for in the past 2 years. I think sometimes we can see on the news the Standing Committee of the National Congress discussing some draft about something. So and so, including this one, but it just has not passed through.
Well, what do you see now that we're up to date in this chronology? Mm-hmm. What do you see for the future mm-hmm. of freedom of information mm-hmm. in China as time goes by, mm-hmm. and perhaps as more provincial governments have it at the provincial level and the national law or regulation, I should say, mm-hmm. matures? What do you see for the future?
I'd like to say a few words about the practice map right now.
Please.
After the publication of the state's regulation on freedom of information, the former regulations and rules on the government on the local level has no function at all in China. Because we are not a federal system. We are a central government system. So the local regulation, I should say local legislation should be should not be conflict with the...
Should
adhere to the state regulation.
So that goes to that question that the gentleman asked earlier,
yeah.
or someone actually mentioned in the first panel, mm-hmm. that the effect of the national law has diminished what had been available at the prefectural law level. Mm. That is so that has happened.
Mm.
In other words, the national regulation has replaced
the perfectual regulation.
The national regulation. Mm. Yeah.
Because the national regulation is what now governs everything.
Yeah.
Not the former perfectual.
Yeah.
Provincial.
Provincial. Yeah.
As I had in Japan. So
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. But for local governments, they've been busy with, I think, a lot of things. Some are very important, editing the directory and the content of what kind of information can be disclosed, and the procedure according to the state's regulation. So they've been dealing with this. And the data exchange is, I think, is very, what happened in Guangzhou is pretty earlier than other parts of the country. We've been thinking more and doing things.
Well, you have been ahead of the other provinces from the very beginning in Guangzhou.
Sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, again, looking to the future, mm-hmm. how do you see transparency developing in Japan? What do you see? Sorry, if we were talking about prefectures and Japan, I'd be just fine. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in China, at the provincial level, and now more importantly at the national level, mm-hmm. how do you see things developing?
I would say that the privacy protection and business secret protection will be going ahead, and there's going to be a law or regulation regulating the privacy protection. And I don't think the business secret protection will have a separate law or regulation. It's another tough question. And the definition of privacy in China is also in conflict. Professors and government officers have been quarreling about that.
Well, that's a quarrel with which we're very familiar mm-hmm. in this country, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And that's a quarrel that probably will forever remain a difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. It sounds as if there's much focus now with the initiative at the national level on data protection with respect to business information and personal privacy information. Does that mean that there's less focus on access to ordinary information or government transparency of government operation information?
Not exactly.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. For government transparency, I think the details will be taken care of in future. For example, I know in the United States you've got a federal register, and that will be very helpful to people who wants to get the information from government agencies. But in China, we don't have a regulation around the country about how to write a government register. We have some kind of thing like that, but the details are different. So as lawyers, we always say devil is in the details.
Yes, we say that here as well.
I never said that.
To be sure. Well, we're a little bit over on time because we've been running over for all of our segments this morning, but let me throw it open to any questions that we have from the audiences. One of the gentlemen in the front row over there.
I just have two very quick questions.
You've talked about release of information, like publication of information on government websites, something akin to our Federal Register. Is there now, or is there any move towards something like our FOIA request system, where as a citizen you can file a request, I'd like to know about this, I'd like this record, please.
Yeah, I'd like to say that the system is in building. And if you visit the website, building of the provincial government, and you might see a guide on how to acquire how to make a request and what kind of information you can get.
It sounds like it's somewhat nascent. Could you pass the mic over to the lady right there, and then we'll go back there.
Sorry, just one word. Even if we haven't a steady regulation on how to request, but we have some sections and in the regulation, state regulation, and this is hard for the local government to make decision, but the request, because the request comes every day, almost every day. So it's a tough question. Sorry.
They have the same concerns about administrative burden that you would expect anywhere. Mm. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
I want to keep that low.
Can you hear me? Yeah, that's incredible. Okay. Would your Freedom of Information Act be a way to find out the age of the Chinese gymnast?
This is the controversy over the Olympic gymnastic team from China, where the legal requirement was they had to be at least 16 years of age, and then there were questions as to whether some or others were not 16, and their birth certificate or their passport listing the ages. So the question is whether the national regulation would work as a legal mechanism for getting access to official documents there.
Are you talking about the procedure? As a citizen, if I require, I made a request to get this news about the age or the accurate birth, date of birth of the girls, I will be declined because that's the privacy. But actually, I will tell you the truth. If you want to find their date of birth, you can search on internet and you can surely get that. Some people do that.
To make a point of comparison with the United States.
Yes, through the newspapers and some other.
There's been publicity.
Yeah.
I can just say that I have not researched it, but my understanding was that they were different. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you found on the internet would show different dates, so that wouldn't really be definitive as to what their birthday actually was.
And it could well be that what was disclosed under their transparency regulation would show a discrepancy as well. But on the substantive point of comparison with the United States, if there were a record and the question was disclosure of the birth date or not, in the United States, the ordinary rule would be exactly what Professor Liu says. Mm-hmm. It would be protected on personal privacy grounds. Right. But in the United States, our privacy exemption has an override, to use a phrase that we heard this morning, says that there can be an overriding public interest in disclosure. And I would dare say in this particular case, although it's easy for me or the US to say, there would be a public interest override and the information would be disclosed. Yes, Professor Padua in the back.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a question about the WTO, since that's what that's what you wrote your dissertation about. There's a lot of conversations about the extra transparency obligations that was imposed on China during these negotiations. And a lot has been said about that the Chinese government wanted this extra transparency because it wanted to engage in certain kinds of reform, then it needed it possibly for also internally. But I don't know, I want to hear your perspective, because if things were happening locally anyway, I wonder to what extent, so I want to hear the WTO extra transparency obligations that were imposed on China because, for the accession process, which have had quite an effect. What was that in response to what was happening already at the local level? So it was a matter of controlling it? So I want to see what you see the relationship being on the WTO front. Mm-hmm. And of course, other countries wanting transparency because they want to do foreign investment in China and they want to know everything that's going on and what was happening domestically. I know it's a big topic, so maybe just a little bit. Then we can talk later.
Thank you. That's a really big topic. And I want to say first, before the state regulation, we can't say there's no transparency in China. We just say that's a ungovernmental transparency. So transparency can be undertaken in a very freestyle. So in the freestyle, everything can happen. Some government officials even leak the state secret in the improper situation, because there is no regulation. They don't know what kind of trading secret or conversation secret is crucial to the interests of the country. So that's happened before China's accession to the WTO regulation. So it's hard to explain. Everything might happen during that period, but of course the government wants to be the government, and the people and government can see the necessity of a regulation on freedom of information, so that we can do everything in a more regular way. So we can expect everything happening in this way or that.
Do you think the obligations that were imposed on China were too much on the WTO stuff?
Too much.
Is there a backlash right now in China?
Somewhat too much.
Somewhat.
Several, I'd like to. For example, the 8 years. I'm sorry. I just can't find a word.
Keeping of records?
I think that's strict and maybe unfair.
Translating it into three different languages. Okay. Thanks.
Oh, we have one more question over here, I think. Oh.
I just wanted to know if the professor thinks the new Freedom of Information regulation will help flesh out issues going on in China with respect to this melamine contamination in a lot of different products. It seems to be a big concern now. Do you think the laws can help them get to the bottom of all those problems?
You mean laws can help to resolve every problems?
With respect to a public health and safety issue regarding chemicals or products, food products that might be tainted in some way.
Yeah, partly. At least we know more and more about the details, and it's in the sunshine, and somebody has to take care of that.
Well, as you said, the devil's in it, and that's where you're going to run into some exemption four type issues with respect to reporting and disclosure of that kind of information.
I mean, business confidentiality would certainly come into play, yes.
Yeah, but I'd rather say the key issue is not freedom of information, not information disclosure. The main point is about your rights, the safety or safeguard of our food manufacturing.
But
so that's the different field.
In fairness, though, in the United States, we would say it's not different, because access to government information can promote public health and safety by revealing significant information that, once learned, can improve the safety. If by applying a pressure or by disclosing products that are not properly manufactured. That's a big part of the underpinning of openness in government in our country, disclosing information to help public health and safety. And I know that, I believe that was part of the impetus with respect to the SARS crisis, that there was too little information disclosed at that time. We had a lady in the front row who had a comment I know she wanted to make, and I remember she's been patient there, so.
Hi, I think as for the SARS crisis in 2003, it's a typical example of the information disclosure. I was in Beijing in high school in 2003, and in spring there were rumors about a severe disease is spreading over Hong Kong and Guangzhou, and everybody was so afraid. And in early summer, the disease was was already spreading all over whole China, but none of the media reported there to report this disease under the censorship. And after that, the government realized how severe the situation was, and they published the information about how many people affected about this disease and how to prevent this, and they give tips, and they report the hospitals has taken care of how many people and what the situation was. And even a new hospital was built to treat the SARS patients. And after this information disclosure, and people feel better about the situation, that it is in control. So they can pay attention to preventing getting affected. And in August, in June or July, the situation was under control, and in August it's already the problems was already been solved and it's gone. I think it's a driving force to let people know about the situation, then and let them know they have right to know about what's happening in this whole country, in this society. I think the government is trying hard to do this. There's a trend, there's a driving force for information disclosure.
Yes, I would totally agree with you, Jesse, and I just add a few words. And our governments were, I think, far from mature, either in that time, 2003, or this time. Sometimes they just don't know what kind of information can be disclosed. They are not always trying to protect. As a consultant, because I know some details about them, they are not trying to protect. They just know how to disclose what kind of information can be disclosed.
Well, I can tell you this just as a concluding point. That's not so very different from what the situation was in the United States after our Freedom of Information Act took effect in July of 1967. And as Tom Sussman mentioned this morning, it was relatively toothless for several years. There were a few Ralph Nader type cases and cases brought by consumers union and organizations like that. There were far fewer public interest groups, or NGOs as we now call them, back then. And it really took about 7 years for things to finally advance in this country. And I think it could fairly be said that even in today's age, where you have electronics available to you and kiosks, if you want them, as in Mexico, it will take some time in China. But the very fact that anything at all is happening in China is remarkable in and of itself. So thank you very much for sharing your story with us. And I would hope that we can return the favor by continuing here at the law school to give you lessons and information as best as we can about lessons that you can take back to China as to how to do things better based upon our experience. And who knows, perhaps when we celebrate the 10th annual International Right to Know Day in what it'll be 8 years from now, 2016, perhaps that first panel in the morning will say, oh yes, the best nations of the world, sure, are Mexico, India, and China. Hopefully US will be up there, but who knows, China might be. So thank you very much again for and we're going to take our lunch break now. We're obviously running more than 15 minutes late, but we do have flexibility built into the schedule. And we're going to try to start our third session of the day at just about 1:30. And that will involve looking at those nations of the world that don't quite have a freedom of information regime yet, either in law or practice or regulation, but are getting very, very close. The nations that are poised to join the international freedom of information community.